quite a short period of time. So apologies to those who've listened to a podcast I did with the Development Policy Centre last month. You'll have heard this before. So the story starts in 2009. I was a consultant working on climate change, and I was called to Papua New Guinea to work on the vexed question of REDD+, which I gather we have a panel on tomorrow. So spent the first few weeks in Sydney trying to figure out who was doing what in Papua New Guinea in climate change, environment, agriculture and sustainability issues. And other than a few phone calls to ANU, I didn't get very far. So once we eventually got our visas sorted out and got into PNG, we borrowed a van and drove around Waigani for 2 weeks, talking to every donor we could find and every government office who would talk to us about what their activities were in the field of climate change, environmental sustainability, conservation, agriculture, and so on. And we came up with a decent list, but it took 2 weeks. And for the subsequent 6 months that I spent there, every few weeks we'd bump into another NGO or another donor that we hadn't encountered before who were doing a program that was deeply relevant to our work, but whom we'd not had the opportunity to meet first time around. So that was 2009. So fast forward to where we are now, just under 8 years ahead, and I can do this. Go to dportal.org, select a recipient country, so Papua New Guinea, and what is happening in the aid world in PNG, according to the International Aid Transparency Initiative, online repository of data on development. Well, we have 1,570 projects from 49 organizations, summing over a number of years to many billions of dollars. But this is the bit that I really like, which is for those activities which have been reported with a precise location, which is not all the activities, it's about 15% of those on the registry, but you can go and find out which part of the country these activities are taking place. Unsurprisingly, the largest number are registered to Port Moresby, either because they're taking place locally or more often because they're registered as a national project and the capital is your national location. But if you zoom in a little bit, some of the areas that we were interested in from a climate change standpoint, you can see, for instance, in the CPIC coast around Wewek and Angoram, are there any climate change adaptation or mitigation projects there? Well, this is a project in the CPIC coast, actually. It's an energy sector development project, so probably nothing to do with climate change until you realize that in rural areas, energy is generated primarily by burning diesel, and switching that to solar PV would enable a substantial reduction in emissions. So what this data allows you to do is essentially to browse, to go into the parts of the country you're interested, find out who's doing what, knowing full well that it is incomplete, which is why I say much done, much still to do. But nevertheless, this was completely impossible 7.5 years ago. It would have taken months, if not years, for the development of experts on PNG collectively to have drawn this sort of map of activities. Now, a good chunk of it is available for free online to anyone who wants to access it. And if you want to do a bit of a sector filter, here's one I did earlier just on the environmental sector. So already we're going to a much more manageable, searchable number of projects. Three active projects that are reported, overwhelmingly funded by Australia, 82% of the funding. And we can find out what this is. Climate and Ocean Support Program, a climate change resilience program from DFAT to strengthen capacities of communities for $1 million. Okay, and then another $1 million. That means $1 million committed, $500,000 expended so far. So this might not be all the information that you want to know, but at the very least it gives you a healthy starting point to take up in discussion when you eventually meet the DFAT people in Moresby. What's this program about? How's it going? Who are the involved communities? And so on. So let me go from the general, from the specific to the general. This is the summary of the findings of the Aid Transparency Index, which is a survey compiled by my organization, Publish What You Fund, every year or two on the quality and quantity of information made available on aid and development in open formats. And our methodology was more or less unchanged between 2013 and 16, so these are comparable data. In 2013, we had four big donors meeting the highest transparency standard, our very good category, and a further five in the good category, and we will find AusAid, as then was here, at 43% in the fair category. Now, let's go forward to 2016. That's the last index we did about 8 months ago, and we now have 10 agencies in the very good category, most of the same ones as 2013, but with the addition of a number of the multilateral development banks and some UN agencies, also the US Millennium Challenge Corporation. And then we have a further eight in the good category. And these two categories between them constitute something like 40% of global ODA. And the very good category alone, because it includes the World Bank, DFID, and a number of other biggies, accounts for 25% of global ODA. So from practically nothing 7 years ago and less than 10% in 2013, we now have 25% of aid and development spending meeting very good transparency standards. And I think that's excellent progress by almost any standards. Now, of course, the flip side of that, 75% of aid does not yet meet very good transparency standards. I'm sorry to say that DFAT is in that category, coming out at, 49.9% in the last index in 2016. I was having some conversations over lunchtime about how that can be changed. We hope it will. The nice thing about this index is it does produce a race to the top. People quite like doing well in it. It's a relatively easy thing to do well at. You need a few people and you need to spend some money. But the results are huge, as demonstrated in the map that I started with. So why should we care about transparency, other than because it sounds good? Well, I'd argue there are three reasons that if we care about effectiveness of aid and development cooperation, we should therefore care about transparency. The first is for better planning and coordination. This is a particular concern to governments who either get a large chunk of their budget from aid flows or where aid agencies and development finance institutions are relatively important to the size of the economy. And in this part of the world, that includes Timor-Leste and Myanmar, who've both developed portals to integrate these open IATI data with their national budget systems. And generally, you find that the countries that care about budget transparency and effective budgeting also care about integrating aid data, because in the end, from the point of view of consumer of public services, you don't really care whether the tax dollar came from Australia or from your domestic source or from wherever. You care about the service that was delivered and whether it got to you. The second reason to care is for the purposes of accountability. And I feel in these days of the simultaneous rise of authoritarian leaders, but also the decline in trust in elected leaders worldwide, we need accountability more than ever. And as a citizen of a still European country, I would contend that one of the reasons that the aid budget has not been cut yet in that still European country is because DFID can demonstrate to a high standard of accuracy and confidence what it does with its money, which means that even the incoming government did not feel able to cut its budget or to downplay the importance of the department. We'll be working to make sure it stays that way. Third reason we should care, I'm in an academic institution, so I will say this is particularly important for researchers and the policy community, and that is learning. And this brings me back to the keynote presentation by Michael Walcott this morning, which I really enjoyed. How can we know what to do if we're not building on the experience of others? How can we know what to allocate if we can't see the allocations of others? And how can we learn by doing if we are not sharing our experiences and our doings as we go? So those are my three reasons for transparency: effectiveness, as expressed in planning and budgeting, accountability, and learning. And I'll close with a call or an exhortation, if you like. And this is fairly broad brush because I don't quite know the mix of people we have in the room. If you're a data publisher, or if you produce data but are not yet publishing it, now whether that's a government department or NGO or a private contractor, please publish it. If you're engaged in aid, development cooperation, or development finance, the IATI standard is the global standard for doing this. It's voluntary, no one's forced to use it, but over 500 organisations worldwide are using it. And if you're engaged in public contracting, a growing number of organisations are adopting an open contracting data standard, which allows you to search public contract details in much the same way as you can now search those aid details. And one of the early adopters of that standard is Slovakia, which was able to substantially reduce public corruption in municipal government as a result of publishing all contracts entered into by all municipalities across Slovakia. Second, if you have data, and many of us, especially in large bureaucracies, are sitting on big treasure troves of data, let's use it. Let's not take the alternative fact worldview to be inevitable. Let's use the data that we have for better policymaking, decision-making, planning, budgeting, and learning. The scientific worldview will triumph in the end. It's our responsibility to make sure that the time until that does is as short as possible. And finally, if you don't have data, and this is particularly applicable to the civil society people in the room, especially those working with grassroots campaigners, activists, maybe in Asia and the Pacific, and I met a fair few of those during my time in PNG. If you don't have data, please demand it. It's not enough to have a Freedom of Information Act. You need to be hammering the agencies with requests under that Freedom of Information Act to the point they get so bored responding to the requests they just put it out there online so people can go fill their boots with data themselves without having to bother the civil servants with responding to all those requests. And this actually works, by the way. I did a count of the number of Freedom of Information requests that UK's Department for International Development received over a six-year period. The number of requests didn't go down, but the number of requests which could be answered by saying, thank you, please look at our website, did go up very substantially. So I'm pretty confident that the civil service processing time did go down. So just to sum up, if you produce data, please publish it. If you have data, please use it. And if you don't have data, please demand it. Thank you.
So Rupert has not only been accurate and transparent, but he's also been faster than, hasn't even got the poison numbers yet for wrapping up. Thank you. What I plan to do is, perhaps if you wouldn't mind staying there a second, we'll have a few questions after each speaker. People talking on quite diverse aspects of this question, so it might be good for the final half hour just to have a broad-ranging discussion how all this fits together. But are there any questions of Rupert after his presentation? I have two rude ones if you can't think of anything better, so please.
There's one at the back.
Thank you for your presentation. Are there any parallels you can draw between this and the cluster coordination response, the reform of humanitarian response with the clusters and the 4W mapping that occurs in a humanitarian crisis where it's very easy to look up who's doing what where from humanitarian response review? Perspective, like, are there any lessons you can learn from OCHA, who do a lot of information management exactly for this reason, but just on a much bigger turnover? Yeah, are there any parallels you can draw from the humanitarian community that the development sector can take on?
Did everyone hear the question? Very good. So the short answer is yes. And the longer answer is that there's a program of coordination between the IATI Secretariat and UNOCHA to bring the standards for financial reporting and activity monitoring as close together as they can be. They'll never be exactly the same because IATI was originally designed for development activities, typically updated monthly or quarterly, and the OCHA tracking system, the financial tracking system, is designed to be updated every day as in an earthquake or a typhoon response situation. But they are moving closer and closer together. And having worked a little bit on disaster relief during the Ebola crisis in West Africa, I can assure you that there is, although there is a philosophical humanitarian development divide and a policy one, on the ground in the Ebola response, humanitarians, development people, and indeed the military, were all pulling in the same direction, and efficient data sharing would have helped a great deal. We did what we could. Technology has actually improved enough in the last 2.5 years that we could do a great deal better this time round.
Thank you very much. That's great. Just wondering about the pushback that you receive from governments or NGOs or whoever. Is it, we'd love to, but we're terribly important and terribly busy? Is it, we don't agree? Just wondering what the counter-arguments you hear are.
There are three. One's valid, the other's not valid, and one's sort of half valid. So the one that's valid is, so who's using this data anyway? And the answer to that is we don't know enough about that. We know that some governments are using it and importing it into their budget systems, and that's great, and they should carry on doing that. We know that civil society people are interested in it, but right now the format is not user-friendly enough, and frankly the data quality isn't good enough for routine monitoring and accountability work by civil society. And that is a big, big problem. And next week we're kicking off a piece of research in Tanzania and Benin on how civil society groups want to use data and the extent to which they could if they knew it was there. So maybe I'll have a better answer to that in 6 months. But yes, lack of use is a big problem. The invalid response is, oh, this infringes privacy and data protection laws. I hear that one a lot in Germany. The reason it's invalid is because it's perfectly possible and indeed the correct thing to do to redact sensitive information when you publish IATI data. So particularly when you're working in an area where there's a war or a civil war and you can't trust the authorities with the information, publishers can and do redact data. They need to have protocols in place to do that properly, but it can be dealt with. The one that's sort of half valid is the resourcing and it takes time to do this question. And yes, it does, but it's not a dramatic level of resource. You know, it's in the hundreds of thousands rather than the millions, and it's in the single digits of people. You know, the World Bank and the big UN agencies who have programs of quite considerable complexity amounting to tens of billions of dollars a year can do this with you know, a few people managing the publication.
Which of those three does
DFAT
use?
I'd ask DFAT that question.
I do feel you've thrown a gauntlet down about DFAT. And for those of us who are now outside trying to look in, it's quite clear that there's less transparency possibly than there was 3 to 4 years ago. So what does DFAT need to do to get out of your fair ruck there and start moving up that pole?
So frequency of publication is helpful, so publishing data monthly rather than quarterly. The three big things, and they're difficult things, so let's not pretend this will happen overnight. One is data on results, so not only how much money went out, but what did it accomplish, and that's a whole debate, right? And the open data won't resolve that debate, but more data will help. The second is forward-looking budget information, so wherever possible, if you already know that you're planning to spend a certain amount of money this year or next year, then put that down, and don't be afraid that it's going to change, because of course it changes, right? IATI is not the OECD. We're not scoring people on whether their projections turned out to be correct or not. That's not the point. This is real-time information sharing. And the third thing is sub-national locations. So colouring in the map of PNG. Right now, 15% of activities in PNG have sub-national location data. If you got DFAT to publish all of that data, it would be I don't know if it would be in the 30s or 40s, but it would be a great deal higher than 15%. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We now turn to Neil Forster. Neil is an assistant director of the Office of Development Effectiveness in DFAT. background in that area and before that in program management in the old AusAid. It's probably hard to speak to a challenging topic like aid
effectiveness.
What's wrong with performance management systems and a way forward? So we look with great interest.
Good. Thank you. So it's good to see so many of you here today, and it's always a pleasure to see so many people interested in aid effectiveness. It's also good to see so many familiar faces here from over the years. Although I do wonder how many of you are here out of curiosity to hear my confessions. But I'd like to suggest that although I'm the one presenting the confessions, they're actually your confessions as well. But we can debate that at the end of the presentation. So I also want to emphasise that DFAT, the Australian Aid Program, takes performance seriously, and we are always trying to improve the effectiveness of the aid program. And that's partly why I'm here today, to test some new ideas. And it's also to emphasise that aid effectiveness is really challenging. So there's no easy answers, and it's not just Australian Aid, but all donors really struggle to tackle this issue. So I don't have a lot of time, so my presentation is very focused. It's focused on one single question. I'm not sure if it's a confessional question or whether that's something that's possible, but it is focused on one question. And what I will do is to highlight how I arrived at that question. I'll talk about why the question is important. I'll talk about how the aid sector came to this point. I'll then provide an answer to the question. And then most importantly, I'll provide a solution. So I've got to keep going because there's quite a lot to cover in a short space of time. So, what is the question? Let's see if I can... I'll read it out because it's the fundamental question for this presentation. Why can't aid projects report clearly and simply, in a robust way, whether they are on track to achieve their final objectives or outcomes? So it's quite a big call for me to come to this question, and I'm sure at least some of you here might not agree with the premise. So let me explain how I arrived at this question. So for 3.5 years, I was the aid effectiveness specialist for the Australian Aid Program based in Hanoi. And in that role, I was responsible for quality appraising the annual progress reports of all the projects in the region. So that's Australian aid projects in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, as well as the Southeast Asia regional programs. And that involved a lot of reading. It involved a lot of reading very long reports. And after about 3 years, I'm a slow learner, I started to see a pattern. And the pattern was this, that these reports weren't telling me what I wanted to know. They weren't telling me clearly if the project was on track or not. So I started to think more deeply about why this is actually going on. So I also said I'd emphasise, well, why is this an important question? And it's a fundamental issue, I think, because if a project can't clearly explain whether they're on track or not to achieve their objectives, how on earth do they manage their projects? How do they make decisions as to where to focus their efforts, where to put their resources? Because, quite simply, if they're not managing to achieve their objectives, how can they be more effective? So I think that goes without saying that it's a really important question to ask. So I'm not the first person to raise this as a question, and there's lots of debate as to why sometimes the quality of reporting isn't of high quality, isn't able to answer this question. Does it relate to capacity? Is it simply a challenge for the people writing the report to explain clearly the answer to that question? Is it possibly about incentives? Is there some basis for thinking that, well, projects actually know what's going on, they know whether they're on track or not, but they don't actually write it down? So that's also, I thought, a possibility. Or is it possibly convenience that, well, we've been reporting this way for the last 25 years, no one seems to really complain about the quality of our reporting, so we'll just keep doing it the way we've always been doing it? Or, and this is quite a popular area of thinking, that, well, life and projects are just too damn complicated. We don't really know what's going on, and that means we can't be that precise about whether we are on track or not to achieve our objectives. So they're all valid reasons, but I thought there's something more fundamental going on. And it's something that I really blame as the, I can't really say the root of all evil, but it's fundamental to the reason why projects aren't reporting clearly as to whether they're on track or not. And I blame it on program logic. Now, we all know what program logic is. I think we've all been to the training. It's sort of embedded in our psyche, working in the aid sector, that program logic is the basis upon which projects deliver their objectives. We all know the transition from inputs to activities to outputs to outcomes to impact. And what I'm arguing here is that program logic doesn't actually reflect reality. If I had time, I have to ask this rhetorically, but how many of you have actually seen a project actually turn out this way, where it's sort of almost like clockwork, that everything just goes to plan and out pops the impact at the end of the project? So that's where I think the problem lies, and a lot of other people in institutions are also trying to address this issue. And I think the main way that that's occurred is through the theory of change thinking and training, where there's a much greater focus on outcomes as a way of tracking progress. And there's also a lot of institutions like the Donor Committee for Enterprise Development, the DCED, which I think we're going to hear a little bit about tomorrow. They're also trying different ways of tracking progress. Another area is in the good governance, working politically area, which is trying to tackle this issue. But often I find that something gets lost, that the theory of change working is talked about at the design stage, but when you get to implementation, you're back to the old program logic. So why is this so? And I think these initiatives from other institutions, they're certainly valuable and they are making changes occur, but it's not changing things across the board. We're still, on the whole, having projects which aren't reporting clearly whether they're on track or not. So that's the answer to my question, and now I should have a drum. Do we have drum rolls here? Thank you. The solution. And the solution's pretty simple. That's it. Sometimes the simple solutions are the best. And what it's saying is that instead of worrying about the old-style program logic, we should simply be tracking outcomes. outcomes, the tracking of outcomes will tell us if we are on track to achieve our final outcome. And what's particularly different here is the proposal I'm making that outcomes actually start on day one. Well, they start at the very beginning of a project and they continue on until the very end of the project. So it's not like the old program logic approach where you have to wait 18 months to see an outcome and you just, everyone's busy doing other stuff and promising people that the outcome will come. No, here you have to start measuring outcomes from day one. And the argument is that it's a sequential set of outcomes. Now, I'm not sure if it's useful to explain again what is an outcome, but this is what I came up with, which seemed to suit what I was trying to say today. And it really explains why we're here, or why we work in the aid sector, is to try to enable outcomes to occur. So, if it's a sequential set of outcomes, I thought I have to give it a new name. We're good in the aid sector at giving new names to things. So I referred to it as the outcome roadmap. So it's a set of sequential outcomes. These outcomes are time-based and they're focused on quality. That's the key elements of the outcome roadmap. So what would this look like in an M&E type framework? Well, before doing so, let me give an example. This is an example of a project I was involved in on financial inclusion in the Mekong region. The basic premise of the project was that financial institutions don't provide financial services to more disadvantaged communities. So, for example, the opportunity to open bank accounts, because it's just not economically viable for that financial institution. So the role of aid in this situation is to give a subsidy to these financial institutions to enable them to provide these financial services to the communities. And over time, that subsidy would be phased out. So the basic theory of change is this, that you need the cost of financial service expansion to be reduced. If that doesn't occur, the financial institution wouldn't expand to those communities. Then you've got a basic supply and then demand followed by better use of financial services. So what I'm arguing here today is that that is your M&E framework or your performance management framework. I don't really care about the details about how you get to those outcomes. But as manager, that's what you should be aiming for, and that's what you should know when it will occur and how it will occur. So the basic framework would simply look like this. Nice and simple, a one-page outcome framework which gives you the dates of when you expect that to occur, and with more detail you'd provide information on the quality or quantity of those steps. So you're probably thinking, this is too good to be true. And this is a question I'll ask you at the end. Why aren't we using this type of performance management system that simply tracks outcomes? I'm not saying you don't report against your activities and your inputs and your outputs, but that all goes in the annex. On the first page of your progress report, you tell me about how you're tracking against your outcomes and whether you're on track to achieve your final objectives. I also want to again emphasise that the outcomes start from day one. They're not starting in 18 months' time. So if you see the first outcome is cost of financial services reduced, well, if you break that down further, you see that the first outcome is an expression of interest from a financial institution to be involved in this contractual arrangements. I don't care about the templates or all the stuff that goes on in terms of getting to that point. I want to know, are you, the project, going to reach this outcome by the date you said or not? So what else needs to happen for this to work? I'm running out of time, so I'm going to really focus on, I think, two issues that need to be in place for this type of outcome mapping to occur. The first is you have to get the contract right. If you've got a contract which encourages or focuses on the achievement of activities and outputs, guess what you're going to get? Activities and outputs. So you need a contract which provides an incentive to provide outcomes. Now, I've got a few ideas on what that contract might look like, but I don't have time to talk about that today. But the number of times I've seen a good design destroyed by a bad contract. I don't know if there's anyone in contracts here, but it's so easy to be done if the contract doesn't fit the needs of the project. The second critical thing is to have the technical expertise necessary to assess whether the outcomes are occurring and whether they're occurring at the quality that's required. Who's going to do that? Because donors, including the Australian Aid Program, are going to be afraid of a performance management system that only produces and reports against outcomes. Everyone likes things that are solid, that you can see. So you're going to need a system where those outcomes are verifiable and can be validated. So there is a need for some technical expertise to assess those outcomes, something like a technical advisory group. So that's the key message that I want to bring to you today, and I'd like to open the floor to get your response as to whether you think, when you think about your own projects, what would happen if you move to an outcome-focused monitoring and evaluation system where you threw away the 10-page log frame or the 20-page monitoring framework and you just focused on the theory of change and the outcomes required in order to achieve your final objectives in the time and in budget that's necessary. So thank you, and I'll just put up a couple of very useful further readings that I've come across recently. They're not completely in line with what I've spoken about today, but I found particularly the paper on contracts very useful, because if you don't get that right, then the program won't deliver outcomes. Thank you.
Let's start your next step then. Reactions?
Hi, I'm Juliet Hunt. I've been a consultant or activist in the gender equality field for some years, working with a range of different types of organisations, CSOs, as well as on bilateral projects and multilateral. I just wanted to pose some counterpoints or questions to your questions. Shouldn't we also ask why the program logic is unrealistic? And what are the answers to that question? Can we unpack that? And do you think that that DFAT and the staff at DFAT are giving clear and consistent messages about their expectations of what quality reporting against outcomes are in their negotiations and discussions with their partners, whether they're government or civil society or NGOs? And my final one is, I agree with you completely about needing, I don't disagree with anything necessarily that you're saying, but particularly I agree with the need for technical expertise necessary to assess the quality of outcomes. Sorry, I'm going to ask probably a bit of a feisty question now. Does EFAT have the technical expertise, do you think, to assess the quality of outcomes and the theory of change and the program logic? And therefore, I guess it's a bit the same as the second question, isn't it? And therefore, the quality of the reporting? Sorry.
No, that's fine. I think it's a good question. I might put that one on notice.
No, look, I'm just speaking from a practitioner at the other end of the stick, and I do need to be honest that I do think there are some mixed messages, and there's nothing wrong with change and growth and adaptation. I'm not arguing against that. And it's good that our M&E expectations change and increase. And I tell the people I work with, look, we have to get used to jumping over a higher jump every time we do a program design. We do, and that's okay. But I think there's also a need for some consistency in the messaging and the feedback. And for that to be really well-founded, because when it comes back to practitioners, and I don't mean people like me, I mean, you know, in-country, local people, and when it's very difficult to explain, why don't they get that? You know, so the questions I get asked are, why don't they get that? Like, isn't it on page 2? You know, like, I get that a lot. I get that a lot. So I'm just sharing that with you.
I understand. It's not an easy question to answer, and perhaps we can go and have a coffee later on. But as I said at the start, this is part of the, I don't want to use the word innovation, but I'm throwing out there a new way of thinking about performance management and M&E systems. And it will take a long time for this to be considered and for any change to occur. But not only, I think, is it the only way forward if we are really serious about aid effectiveness, but I think importantly for DFAT, it's a simpler system. You know, if projects themselves actually stated more clearly whether they were on track or not, imagine how happy DFAT would be. Because I also find this as a challenging issue for DFAT, is that you've got people who are asked to read these reports and then assess progress. And without having clearness and clarity, that is very challenging. So I see that this is in the interest of all parties to move to a more simpler system which actually provides the answers that we want. But it's a long road, and there's a lot of history as to why we are where we are. And so this is simply the very start of trying to encourage programs to change. I'd also emphasise that it is also about having a good relationship with the DFAT counterpart or your person that you deal with in DFAT, because there are risks involved with this approach. So you need to also have that discussion that this is an approach that can work. It will work better for me as a manager, and it will work better for you as the contractor. Sorry, as the DFAT officer. So it's a two-way partnership here, and it will take time, but it is possible. I have seen examples. There are projects out there that have this type of management system.
Thank you, and I heard he owes you a coffee. sorry, there was
Simon Ernst from DFAT. I just wanted to...
Simon, I told you not to say.
So listening to Neil's presentation, I didn't hear him say at any point DFAT has all the expertise to do this. You know, so when he's talking about needing the technical expertise to assess the quality of outcomes, etc., he was talking about through technical advisory groups and so on. For a long time, AusAid before DFAT has contracted in that sort of function, so we could have a debate about whether we're doing that enough, but I don't think the question is really about whether DFAT has enough expertise to look at every single project and every single the answer to that's probably clearly no. It's about more about a partnership with the consulting community, the contracting community, civil society, and so on.
Okay. Sorry, there's all sorts of hands. One here, here, and here. And would you mind, I'm sorry, I'm the right-wing bias, obviously. Can we come back to the other people when we have a general discussion later? Because I don't want Joe to have a chance in a minute. Yeah. What time are we finishing? Is it...
10 past 5.
Ten past five. Okay,
Joe's
so...
20 minutes to speak. No, 20 minutes.
Just three quick questions, if you can, and we'll get Joe to you. Starting here.
Hey, well, thank you for your presentation. Julie Harris from the procurement team at Ilfac in Wellington. My job is to be the red marker and the track changer on every contract that goes out for aid, provided we get them across the desk. And what we're finding increasingly is a change of wanting to avoid the changes of having to increase the quality of the contract. I mean, I think that things like quantify your outcomes. What are you trying to achieve? It's not in the design document, we just copied the design document. So on one hand, you've got procurement, where we're procuring highly qualified people from big lots of money who expect that sort of quantifiable benchmarks and don't present any problems. On the other hand, when we're going to do smaller projects in the city, they run a mile when we start to put out there, what are your inputs, what are your outputs, what are your outcomes, quantify it, make them accountable to it, put your incentives around that, and it's just getting, it's always in the too hard basket. I'm not a popular staff member, I I'll just be interested in your comments on some of that.
Well, it is difficult, and I think, from my experience, what one way that can work in terms of a contractual arrangement is, well, firstly, it has the principle you let the people, the experts, get on with it. So you don't try and tie them down in terms of the way in which it should be done around payment milestones on inputs and outputs. You let them get on with it. They're the experts. And you pay... The payment milestones are on the basis of the receipt of good quality 6-monthly annual reports of progress. And of course, there's a defined menu of things that the contractor can spend their money on, but that's worked out through an annual planning process. So you've got a very simple contractual arrangements, but parallel to that, you've got a tag team who is looking at the quality of the reported outcomes that are being presented in these 6-monthly annual reports and assessing whether, well, is this theory of change actually working? Is the quality of the outcomes as expected and on time? And providing that assessment independently to the donor. And if those reports start to say, well, actually, this project is going way off track, the outcomes aren't occurring as we expected, then that's when the donor comes in and says, hang on, what's going on? Are we off track, or can you right the boat and get us back onto the track? But the beauty of that approach is that the incentives are there to achieve outcomes rather than the achievement of inputs and outputs.
Thanks for that. Last question.
Thank you very much for the presentation. My name is Yasin, and UBI, I work for the Center of Humanitarian Leadership at Deakin University. My question is that I really like the idea of detailed tracking of outcome from the day one. But the question is, how feasible do you see the approach and the model for some of the humanitarian democracy and peace building project or programs, where you cannot really project your outcome ahead of the time? I detailed work experience in Afghanistan working with community, and now, like after 6 or 10 years, I'm sometimes judging my contribution and the result of this program, which is now visible, but wasn't visible after two years. So I wonder how it would be possible to measure outcome in such an early stage.
Yes, and I think the answer to that is that this approach isn't going to be applicable to all types of projects. There's going to be projects like you've just spoken about. There's going to be simple projects where you're, in a technical sense, simple, where you're building a bridge. Now, that's not a project you're going to be tracking outcomes unless it's an impact assessment at the end of the project. So it is really focused on those more complex, those more institutional change projects where the change process is difficult to understand, but can only be tracked if there is a sense of having an outcome roadmap to follow. So not for all projects, but you have to make that call as to whether this might work for your situation.
Thank you. John Spriggs from the University of Canberra. ACR is in the research for development business, and they seem to be hitching their wagon to the impact pathway sort of idea. So just wondering, would you consider sort of adding that into your outcomes model?
Mm. Well, I'm not familiar with that, but it's quite possible that it's very similar to the approach that I've proposed here.
It's similar, but it gives one of the advantages of the impact pathway is that what I've found is that it encourages researchers to lift their heads,
mm-hmm.
focus on what the end game is rather than focus on researchers and end in this order.
Yes.
That kind of idea.
Well, I think that's very valid, but just from what you've said, the real emphasis here is this idea that...
It's based on theory of change. Yeah.
Well, also, yes, that outcomes start at the beginning.
Yeah.
That we're all good at coming along at the impact evaluation stage to look at whether the outcomes occurred, but the argument here is that's often too late. You need to be tracking outcomes
Absolutely.
From early on.
Okay. Well, thank you very
okay.
much. Now, Jo. Many of you will know Jo. She has worked also in the Office of Development Effectiveness for a long time, but is an independent consultant now and worked in various places over the years. So we're going to talk about what are we measuring when we talk about aid effectiveness, and Jo is going to offer nothing less than a new typology of aid.
Thank you, Murray. So thank you all very much, especially the one standing at the back all afternoon. So I spent about 30 years working in international aid, over which time it's become clear that we're not that we're still uncertain about what works and what doesn't work, and we know that some things work in some contexts and not others. And given that the highly political nature of aid, then I think there's a problem in terms of the evidence that we're bringing to those to balance those political decision-making processes. So I think we need new ways of measuring aid effectiveness. So how is it currently measured? In the literature, there are basically three ways. First of all, does aid work? That's a sort of macro-level question. Second, is it effectively managed? That's to do with the Paris principles and the aid effectiveness agenda. And thirdly, by evaluating individual aid projects, where the question is usually around, is the project relevant, effective, efficient, impactful, and so on. I'm just going to talk about the first of these. Does aid work? To answer this question, we have to agree on what we mean by aid, and we have to agree on what we mean by it working. And in the literature, the way that this is the standard way of measuring this uses econometric modelling to find a relationship between aid volume in dollars and economic growth on the other side. I suggest that economic growth is not enough to be measuring. Aid has got multiple goals over the years. You know, in the 50s, maybe economic growth was fairly recognised as being the main goal, but since then, health, education, inequality have been added. We had the Millennium Development Goals. We now have 17 sustainable development goals, and economic growth on its own is not a sufficient measure. But possibly worse than that is this means of measuring, the method of measuring aid doesn't tell us anything about the role and the theory and the mechanisms of what is happening between the aid volume going in and the economic growth coming out. So all the mechanisms, or in that what we call the black box, are hidden through this method. On the other side of the equation, aid volume is also not enough of a measure. It suggests that the volume of aid is the most significant thing about it, and that's only the case if you have a sort of linear single theory of aid, is that aid is about filling a finance gap. But we know that aid is about a whole lot of other things, like policy influence, like capacity building, and so on. All those different mechanisms, again, are hidden in this method. Also, looking at aid volume is not a comprehensive measure because it's been relying on OECD data, so it's excluding largely what the what we're calling the emerging donors, even though they've been around for a long time. It's largely excluding those funds. It's largely excluding the NGOs and civil society. And the NGOs and civil society have been excluded a lot from the aid effectiveness debate, even though their volume of funding is perhaps, you know, they're perhaps responsible for a third of aid funds. This is Roger Vidal's estimate. And that includes money that is raised by philanthropic through philanthropic donations, as well as money that they are implementing on behalf of donors. So within that, not only is it not measuring, it's not a comprehensive measure, it's also the by excluding the NGOs and civil society, there's a lot of the mechanisms by which aid comes about or that aid operates that are also being excluded. Now, using this sort of equation of aid volume and economic growth also doesn't give us very conclusive findings. So it's basically saying, well, yes, it works in some context and not in others. Surprise, this is what we already knew. So I think the method doesn't suit the task and the question is wrong. So the question should be, what type of aid works for whom, in what circumstances, in what respects, and how? So my research is looking to develop and test a method to measure the effectiveness at a country level. So the idea is not macro and not micro, so not global and not individual projects, of which we have heard there are many, many thousands, but at a sort of MISO level. And I think a country is a kind of a convenient unit at which this would be helpful to measure it. And then it would be a convenient unit because then policymakers can actually make use of that information. So what I'm going to be looking to do is develop a practical, useful, sound method of evaluating aid effectiveness at a country level. And a preliminary part of developing that methodology is asking this question: can we identify the main mechanisms by which aid works and develop a typology of aid on this basis? So just briefly, what are the current typologies? So you can split aid in many, many ways, and we do, by sector, by modalities, or by these three sort of current typologies that are out there. So Roger Vidal, again, he splits it by official development aid, aid provided by NGOs, humanitarian and emergency aid. None other than Stephen Howes splits it by technical assistance for governance, budget support and projects. And within the literature that I was describing, that looks at aid volume versus economic growth, they've actually started to disaggregate using technical assistance, food aid, project aid, financial program aid. But projects, like all aid is a project, right? Even budget support is kind of a project. Projects, a small community development project will have a very different mechanism than a World Bank loan for a, you know, for building a bridge. So it's still not telling us anything about that black box or those mechanisms. And also, even when you split it this way, still we're looking at the volume of aid according to each of those, which is, as I've said, not sufficient. What do we mean by a mechanism? Okay, so a realist approach, which is where my research is coming from, is that it's not the intervention itself that brings about change, but the interaction of the intervention's mechanism with the context in which it operates. So that includes the participants and their identity, norms, beliefs and capacities, as well as the community culture, the organisational culture within which it operates. And this explains why some interventions work for some people and not others, work in some contexts and not others. So a realist approach argues that that the interventions have a mechanism or multiple mechanisms by which they actually bring about change, but the particular context will only allow certain mechanisms to fire. So the idea, what this approach is developed by, particularly by Pawson and Tilley, and Ray Pawson, University of Leeds, uses the analogy of gunpowder to explain what this mechanism idea is. So the idea is that we know what the mechanism is for why gunpowder explodes. It has to do with the chemical structure, that when you apply a spark to it, there's a big exothermic reaction. That is the mechanism. But the context, right, has to do with how compacted the gunpowder is. Is there sufficient volume? Is it damp? Have you applied the spark for long enough? And so whether or not it's going to explode depends on the context. Right? So that's the sort of way of thinking about mechanisms. And so when in a realist evaluation, you're looking at this combination of context mechanisms and outcomes. And in a realist synthesis, which is like gathering at this meso level that I'm talking about, you're trying to find out these CMO kind of combinations at a higher order of abstraction. And the point is that you are continually refining these combinations of context, mechanism, and outcome. Like the program theory for how something is working. So I'm hoping we can use this realist synthesis approach to answer this classic realist question: what types of aid work for whom, in what circumstances, and in what respects, and how? So I come back to, can we identify the main mechanisms by which aid works and develop a typology of aid on this basis? So how did I do this? I looked at lots and lots and lots of projects and project evaluations, project designs, and so on. And here's the list. So this was much harder than I thought. It's really difficult to identify the precise mechanism by which something is working because not everything is using this sort of realist approach. But because I'm working at this sort of meso level, I think you can kind of group them into families of similar things, and it kind of makes sense. It's what I call the imperfect list, so feel free to refine it for me or help me refine it. The group on the left has finance provision and provision of equipment and so on. Those things, I put them on the left just because the volume of aid in those cases is probably not a bad measure. But all the list on the right, those things, the volume of aid is not the most important thing about those. So capacity building, community mobilisation, policy influence, those are all kinds of things that everyone's familiar with. Down the bottom, I'm struggling with the actual naming of some of these. So this cross-cultural exchange, it's not a good title, but it has to do with this demonstration or exposure effect, the way in which sort of worldviews and paradigms are formed. The sort of conscientization, Paulo Freire would call it. If we think about the scholarship program, for example, and is Ian? No. But I was there was a moment when the scholarships program or all scholarships operate not just by an education mechanism, but also by this sort of exposure demonstration effect, where people get to see different worldviews, understand different ways of thinking, and that is in fact the thing that is having an effect as more than the educational effect alone. Another example is in a little village in PNG where there's a small NGO program where the NGO itself has got women on the staff, and when those women are going into the village, just the fact of them being there exposes the women in the village. When they see these women staff members of the NGO, that opens the possibility for other roles for women. So that's You know, it's just one example of that, this what I'm calling cross-cultural exchange, but we're going to change that name. And then the bottom one, advocacy, mass demand for change. This has to do with catalysing grassroots social movements and so on. And some would argue this is, in fact, the major way by which change has ever come about. When you look at the anti-slavery movement or the women's movement. So, anyway, these are my imperfect list of families of mechanisms that will then inform the research. So this is a new typology that I'm proposing. So the point of all this is to shift the debate away from thinking of aid as a single thing, where the volume of funds is considered the most important measure, to open the black box, to start thinking about mechanisms towards measuring what types of aid work for whom, in what circumstances, in what respects and how. And so the next step is to then take this a little bit further to develop and test the methodology for answering that question.